Greetings, Earth Explorers.
The spice extends life.
Welcome to X Squared Radio.
The spice expands consciousness.
I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from somewhere east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast tonight, 20 and clear. The solar wind today is 349.3 kilometers per second, and the proton count is 0.3. 2 major sunspot clusters active on the sun today, and 1416 tripled in size this weekend, and in the process developed a beta-gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for M-class solar flares. Not that you're going to be out there sunbathing or anything, but if something goes wrong with your electronic equipment, you might know why. NOAA forecasters estimate a 30% chance of an M-class flare during the next 24 hours. Any such eruption would likely be Earth-directed, as the sunspot double-barreled shotgun is aiming right for us. On February 3rd, at least somebody's active in the space program, Iran launched the country's third satellite, named the Navid. The 110-pound mini spacecraft is meant to stay in orbit for 18 months, sending back images to Iran as it completes a revolution of Earth every 90 minutes. They're not publishing the images to us, though. Try as we might. We don't really know what they're looking at. But if you have something in your backyard you don't want them to see, you might want to cover it up. By the way, you know what the world's oldest living thing is? No, it's not your third grade teacher. Australian scientists sequenced the DNA of samples of the giant seagrass. That's right. Posidonia oceanic, from 40 underwater meadows in an area spanning more than 2,000 miles from Spain to Cyprus. By the way, we want to say hi to the guys at 100th Monkey Radio Program that came on before us. They went 2 hours live today. Congratulations. You guys are moving up in the world. Hope you got bunches of phone calls from all around the world. They said hi to me in their program. I'm saying hi back. Thanks, Ramon and friends. So the analysis of this seagrass, published in the journal PLOS 1, found the seagrass was between 12,000 and 200,000 years old, and was most likely to be at least 100,000 years old. That is far older than the current known oldest species, a Tasmanian plant that is believed to be 43,000 years old. And that may not be as old as your third grade teacher. Professor Carlos Duarte from the University of Western Australia said the seagrass has been able to reach such old age because it can reproduce asexually, always a good idea, and generate clones of itself. Nobody really knows who originally planted it 100,000 years ago or where it came from, but it is built for survival. Organisms that can only reproduce sexually are inevitably lost because they can't get along with members of the opposite sex. They are continually producing new branches, he told the Daily Telegraph. They spread very slowly and cover a very large area, giving them more area to mine resources. They can then store nutrients within their very large branches during bad conditions for growth. They can also transfer nutrients up and down the organism. Hold on one moment while I decline that. Separate patches of seagrass in the Mediterranean span almost 10 miles and weigh more than 6,000 tons. It is unknown if anything feeds on the seagrass, but Professor Duarte said, somebody should keep trying to call me while I'm on the air, but Professor Duarte said that while the seagrass is one of the world's most resilient organisms, it has begun to decline due to coastal development and global warming. If climate change continues, the outlook of this species is very bad, he said. The seagrass in the Mediterranean is already in clear decline due to shoreline construction and declining water quality. And this decline has been exacerbated by climate change. As the water warms, the organisms move slowly to higher altitudes. The Mediterranean is locked to the north by the European continent, so they cannot move. The outlook is very bad. Now, if an organism that's built for survival doesn't need anything but itself and a few nutrients to get by, cannot survive due to climate change, then I suggest we take a serious look at the way we're living on our planet, because that is what's going on. Just so you know, there's a lot of bantering out there in the press, most of it political, some of it economic, but most of it political, that climate change is a big hoax, that global warming is a hoax. Certain emails got out from people who were suppressing data and information and talking about suppressing data and information, which is never a good idea for science. Don't try to slant the data. Just let it all out and let people make their decisions. But when we have organisms who obviously have a much longer lifespan than we do, a much brighter and wider perspective of what's going on the planet than we do, start reacting and start changing their growth habits and growth patterns because of changes in the climate of the planet, then we have to start listening. Whether we're causing it, or whether it's just, you know, normal undulations in the planetary temperature, it remains to be seen. But come on, people. How many oil spills does it take to figure out we're messing the bottom of the ocean up? Especially in the Mediterranean, where, care and feeding of the ocean has not been one of the top things on the list for the last 500 years, where we've been sailing in and out of there and dumping everything over the side. If you read the book, The Ark of Millions of Years, and I'm talking about Volume 3, which is called Unlocking the Secret, you learned about a very strange device which I, your author, invented, which was called the BIM, the Beryllium Ion Modem. You remember how that worked? Can I see a show of hands? Okay, there's some out there. Here's the thing. The Beryllium Ion lends itself to having particles picked off of it by an electron capture detector, held captive in a magnetic field, and then have their spins reversed. As you know, entangled particle theory is pretty widely known, especially among listeners of this program. It is demonstrable, repeatable, and is now, you know, part of just about any advanced physics regimen, is to learn how to perform entangled particle experiments. No one really knows why it happens. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance, and many, many prognosticators have tried, both trained and untrained, to explain it. It is difficult to explain because we're not really sure if one of two things is happening. Number one, is there some kind of subspace communication that travels faster than the speed of light? Most physicists worth their salt will say no, nothing can go faster than the speed of light, but obviously this does, and so we're unsure. The other is that they may in fact be the same particle, and they're just it's just existing in two places, or that it's some kind of hologram or analog of itself, and that's why when it reverses spin, it reverses instantaneously in the other location. Well, in any case, we had Dr. Jim Bell on the program several years ago. At the time, he was the one that was running the Mars rover programs. This is Spirit and Opportunity, the two small solar-powered rovers that captured everyone's hearts by lasting for several years longer than they were supposed to. One is still alive. I think one of them has died. The batteries finally gave out. Cheapest bidder, I guess. The other one's still hanging in there. So, in my long discussion with Jim Bell, I asked him if he'd ever heard of a Beryllium Ion Modem, because he had said that the communications were very slow between the rovers on Mars and Earth, because we had to send our messages to Marsis, which is an orbiting platform that goes around Mars. The instructions would be picked up by that satellite. It would go around the planet to where Spirit and Opportunity were on the ground, beam the instructions down to the rover, which the satellite would then speed on around the planet. It makes an orbit about every 70 minutes. And then the rovers would perform their task, which sometimes would take several hours because these things consume a very, very small amount of energy. And when the task was completed and the data of the completion was gathered, then it would beam it back up to Marsis, which would come around to the Earth side, broadcast it back to Earth. And, you know, a few minutes later, we would receive the message because it's 43 million miles away from Earth at its closest point. Well, you can imagine how slow and frustrating the communication was. You go through several grad students who would graduate and move on in the life of the program. And for sure, a dial-up modem would be a lot faster than this kind of communication. So I said, why don't you go to the BIM, the beryllium ion modem? And he said, what's that? So I explained it to him, and he said he'd never heard anything like that. I said, well, that's because it hasn't been invented yet, but it will be. Well, that's a big build-up to this article. The BMI, not the BIM, but the BMI, called a brain-machine interface. Yes, you knew it was coming. Researchers found the armed forces could harness the rapid advancement of neuroscience to improve the training of soldiers, pilots, and other personnel. A study from the Royal Society, Britain's National Academy of Science, showed the possible benefits of neuroscience to military and law enforcement. It's always a good place to get funding, okay? That's why they went there. They could have gone a dozen other places than this, including motion picture making, you know, teaching, you know, learning math, difficult, you know, formulas and doing all kinds of robotics. But no, there's no funding in that. So you go to the military and law enforcement. It predicted new designer drugs. Oh, yeah. New designer drugs that can boost performance, make enemy troops fall asleep, and ensure captives become more talkative. I wonder how you get the drugs in the enemy troops. Can I see a show of hands for aerosols? Ah, very good. Yes, that's good. That's good. And, of course, you know, there are other ways of doing it, putting in the drinking water, you know, putting it on money and then leaving the money around to make its way through the money supply. There's lots of ways you can deliver this drug. Anyway, among the more remarkable scenarios suggested in the report involved the use of devices called brain-machine interfaces to connect soldiers' brains directly to military technology, such as drones and weapons. Oh, yeah, we could probably make some more suggestions, too, like a main computer, a mainframe that's run by, you know, a lieutenant, a major, a colonel, a general, a president. The study published on Tuesday, that's how fresh this is. See, we bring you fresh, fresh science here. The study published on Tuesday of this week stated that the work built on previous research that has enabled people to control cursors and artificial limbs through BMIs that read their brain signals. I was not able to get a lot on the previous research, okay? These articles only go back to about November of 2011, and they cover things like cures for insomnia, fake art, you know, different kinds of things, and nothing really serious along these lines. Anyway, in their report, one of a series from the Royal Society looking at the field of neuroscience, the experts call on the UK government to be as transparent as possible. Hey, wait a minute. Transparent? We heard that word. Yes, yes, we have heard that word transparent before. I remember hearing that in the 2008 campaign speeches. Anyway, it's in quotations. I'm not exactly sure if that means that they're trying to say exactly what they said or if the quotes are trying to say, yeah, yeah, we've heard that before. But to be as transparent as possible about research into military law and enforcement applications. Okay, I was holding my breath. I just wanted to see. All right. It goes on, since the human brain can process images, such as targets, much faster than the subject is consciously aware of, we know this from all kinds of Halo games and Modern Warfare 3 games, a neurally interfaced weapon system could provide significant advantages over other system control methods in terms of speed and accuracy. You know, like that pesky right-hand thumb on the Xbox controller. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, your neurally interfaced weapon system, the NIWS, you know, where you can actually move the crosshairs of the weapon with your mind instead of your right thumb. Yeah, interesting stuff, huh? The report also showed how neuroscientists employed so-called transcranial direct current stimulation to improve soldiers' awareness while in hostile environments. Okay, I'm going to translate this for you. You got it? Transcranial direct current stimulation is also called shock therapy. That's right. Now, they can do this two ways. One way is pretty healthy. Tried it. It works. And these are magnetic fields that can electromagnetically be applied to the cranium, your head, your brain, you know, your brain bucket. And it does improve cognizance. It does improve memory. It does improve alertness. It seems to provide a feeling of euphoria, especially in moments and times of great stress. And the other way is maybe not so good for you, but it has also been tried. And this is where it's called deep brain stimulation, where they actually put a coil or a contacts down into the head by drilling a hole in the skull and lowering it into the brain with a very small wire, and then applying an electrical impulse. And the electrical impulse can stimulate memories that have been locked in since you were a child. And this has been used for treatment of Alzheimer's disease and even dementia successfully. Now, they're talking about neuroscientists employing transcranial direct current stimulation to improve soldiers' awareness while in hostile environments. It's pretty hard to stay aware when your eardrums are numb because of all the gunfire going off and explosions. Now, it's not like in the movies, okay, where they're in the hallway and they're firing M16s or AR-15s at each other all over the walls and shooting everything up. And the guy says, "Did you hear that?" "Yeah, I heard that." I'm sorry, folks. You would never hear that. You wouldn't hear that for 2 days because your ears would be ringing. And even if you shoot a revolver out in the backyard, the same thing's going to happen. Wear ear protection. So it's very difficult to stay aware in hostile environments because you cannot hear. And you're under a very stressful situation called imminent death. So this is a way to control the minds of soldiers and make them better soldiers. I told you, they get all the good funding. It showed how soldiers' ability to spot roadside bombs, snipers, and other hidden threats were improved in a virtual reality training program, Modern Warfare 3, used by U.S. troops bound for the Middle East. But the report's authors argued that while hostile uses of neuroscience and related technologies were now more likely, scientists were oblivious to its potentials. They have no idea what we could do with this. While the benefits to society were obvious, I'm a pretty good observer. I'm not seeing it. While the benefits to society were obvious through improved treatments for brain disease and mental illness, what constitutes mental illness? Correctamundo, listeners to X Squared Radio. There were serious security implications to consider. Like people might become, you know, clairvoyant and be able to read your minds. They might become, you know, telekinetic. By the way, give us a call tonight if you've seen the movie Chronicle. Toll-free 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Outside of America, anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can do this. 530-413-6472, 530-413-6472. If you must get out and spend your income tax refund check, please take your cell phone with you and dial into our conference line, 760-569-7676. It's on the website. And put in the passcode 534-355-POUND, and you can listen to the program. You won't be able to talk to us, but you'll be able to listen. But anyway, if you've seen the movie Chronicle, give me a call, because you know, creating or implementing or enhancing one's ability to have telekinesis or telepathic abilities might also be one of the things to consider. Anyway, Professor Rod Flower, chair of the report's working group, said neuroscience will have more of an impact in the future. How does he know that? He goes on to say, people can see a lot of possibilities, but so far, very few have made their way through to actual use. All leaps forward start out this way. What does that mean? They all start out, all leaps forward for the human race start out with money from the military and law enforcement. That's what I'm reading, guys. That's the way I'm seeing it. All leaps forward start out this way. Agree or disagree? 888-429-5471. Really? Seriously? Are all leaps forward for humanity starting with the military? I guess so. I mean, we wouldn't be flying today if it wasn't for the military. We wouldn't have submarines. We wouldn't have gone to space. That was all controlled by the military. Huh. Maybe so. Anyway, Professor Flower from the William Harvey Research Institute at Barts and the London Hospital added, you have a groundswell of ideas, and suddenly you get a step change. If you are controlling a drone and you would shoot the wrong target or bomb at a wedding party, who is responsible for that action? Is it you or the BMI? There's a blurring of the line between individual responsibility and the functioning of the machine. Where do you stop and the machine begin? Interesting question, Mr. Flower. Vince Clark, a cognitive neuroscientist and lead author on the study at the University of New Mexico, admitted he was uncomfortable in knowing neuroscience could be used by the military. As a scientist, I dislike that someone might be hurt by my work, he said. Oh, that guy's going to lose his funding. I want to reduce suffering to make the world a better place, but there are people in the world with different intentions, and I don't know how to deal with that. Burn everything, Vince. If I stop my work, the people who might be helped won't be helped. Almost any technology has a defense application. I would state that a different way, Vince. Almost any technology has an offense application. The Ministry of Defense has not commented on the report. No kidding. Controversial stuff here. We're going to make a better soldier. We're going to put a special helmet on him, and he is going to obey orders. Jeez Louise. And he's going to be aware of his surroundings. And we don't know how that's going to affect him after he gets out, but that's okay. He signed a paper that says we can do it to him. Vince, get everything and get out. Find your funding somewhere else. All right. The Himalayas and nearby peaks. Get this. You know, you climate change people. I'm one of them, okay? And I've been telling you this for a while because the global warming people have been, you know, knocking my door down. I'm saying there's no evidence. There's no evidence. Yes, climate change. But are you sure it's warming? Well, meltwater from Asia's peaks is much less than previously estimated. But lead scientists say the loss of ice caps and glaciers around the world remains a serious concern. Of course we're concerned about that. Absolutely concerned about that. Hopar Glacier in Pakistan, melting ice outside the two largest ice caps, Greenland and Antarctica, is much less than previously estimated, the study has found. The world's greatest snow-capped peaks, which run in a chain from the Himalayas to Tian Shan on the border of China and Kyrgyzstan, have lost no ice over the last decade. Repeat. Lost no ice over the last decade, new research shows. We told you that every major glacier in the world has been growing at an alarming rate. But how can that be? How can that be? It was so hot last summer. We have such a crazy warm winter out here in the East. Yes, it's true. But these undulations back and forth, are what have become so serious. The discovery has stunned scientists. God, all they had to do was listen to X Squared Radio. They wouldn't have been stunned. Gee, let me read this again. The discovery has stunned scientists who had believed that around 50 billion tons of meltwater were being shed each year and not being replaced by new snowfall. The study is the first to survey all the world's ice caps and glaciers and was made possible by the use of satellite data. Overall, the contribution of melting ice outside the two largest caps, Greenland and Antarctica, definitely one of the biggest, is much less than previously estimated, with the lack of ice loss in the Himalayas and the other high peaks of Asia responsible for most of the discrepancy. I was there myself, sat at the bottom of a glacier that was, I don't know how old it is, hundreds of thousands of years old probably, and I didn't see any signs that this glacier was receding. It was huge, stood up there several hundred feet thick. Bristol University glaciologist Professor Jonathan Bamber, who was not part of the research team, said the very unexpected result was the negligible mass loss from high mountain Asia, which is not significantly different from zero. Wow. That's like asking somebody, how are you today? And they say, oh, I'm not unwell. The melting of Himalayan glaciers caused controversy in 2009 when a report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change mistakenly stated that they would be gone by 2035 instead of 2350. That's about a 315-year difference, boys. However, the scientist who led the new work is clear that while greater uncertainty has been discovered in Asia's highest mountains, the melting of ice caps and glaciers around the world remains a serious concern. Of course we're concerned. Our results and those of everyone else show we are losing a huge amount of water into the oceans every year, said Professor John Warr of the University of Colorado. People should be just as worried about the melting of the world's ice as they were before. Don't stop being worried. Don't stop. We need to be ever vigilant. His team's study, published in the journal Nature, concludes that between 443 and 629 billion tons of meltwater overall are added to the world's oceans each year. This raises the sea level by about 1.5 millimeters. That's about this much. Okay. Notice that I have my finger and my thumb about 1/8 of an inch apart. Yes, the team reports. In it, and it's actually less than an eighth, I'm just estimating with my eyeballs here. I don't have a micrometer, but 1.5 millimeters is a little bit, the team reports. It would take 25 years to go up 1 inch at that rate. In addition to the 2 millimeter a year caused by expansion of warming ocean, the scientists are careful to point out that lower altitude glaciers in the Asian mountain ranges, sometimes dubbed the third pole, are definitely melting. These are not the real high ones up around, you know, 14 to 18,000 feet where we were. It's pretty hard to breathe up there, by the way. Satellite images and reports confirm this, but over the study period from 2003 to 2010, enough ice was added to the peaks to compensate. Yes, we all knew and recorded that temperatures earthwise were rising up until 1998. In 1998, they leveled off. And they've actually cooled slightly since 1998, and we've had tremendous amounts of snowfall. I mean, snowfall in Sydney, Australia, snowfall in Rome, okay? Snowfall 21 days in a row in Kentucky. In Kentucky, folks, that's like the South. So we have had it. Now, this winter, admittedly, is pretty mild, and I hope, I'm concerned, but I hope we don't have a summer to match. Let me continue. The impact on predictions for future sea level rise is yet to be fully studied, but Bamber said the projections for sea level rise by 2100 will not change by much, say 5 centimeters or so. Anyway, that's about 2.5 inches. So we are talking about a very small modification. Existing estimates range from 30 centimeters to 1 meter. 1 meter would be a serious problem. A 1 meter change in sea level would make Florida a sandbar. Got it? WAR warned that while crucial to a better understanding of ice melting, the 8 years of data is a relatively short time period, no kidding, that variable monsoons mean, year to year, changes in ice mass of hundreds of billions of tons. It is awfully dangerous to take an 8-year record and predict even the next 8 years, let alone the next century. Yeah, this kind of stuff needs to be studied for 20 or 30 or 40 years. It hasn't been because we haven't had access to those areas. We haven't had satellites up there to take these kinds of images. Keep in mind, these satellites that do this infrared photography have only been around for about 8 or 10 years. The reason for the radical reappraisal of ice melting in Asia is the different ways in which the current and previous studies were conducted. Until now, estimates of meltwater loss for all the world's 200,000 glaciers were based on extrapolations. That means something like knowing what's inside 2 inches and telling you what's at 12 inches. That's an extrapolation of data from a few hundred monitored on the ground. Those glaciers at lower altitudes are much easier for scientists to get to on account of you don't have to climb Mount Everest to get to them. And so we're frequently included. That and most scientists are fat and lazy and won't get up there in the high altitudes to check them out. If you go to Tibet, you land in Lhasa. Lhasa is the capital of Tibet, and its airport is at 11,500 feet. Ding, 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 ding. Most people have a really rough time if they're let off the plane at 11,500 feet. It takes a couple days just to acclimate to there. And that, my friends, is the valley. You have to walk up to 18,500 feet, and that's still a mile below base camp. Yeah, a mile below base camp. Base camp's at 23,000 feet. The new study used a pair of satellites called GRACE, which measure tiny changes in the Earth's gravitational pull. When ice is lost, the gravitational pull weakens and is detected by the orbiting spacecraft. They fly at 500 kilometers, so they see everything, said WAR, including the hard-to-reach high-altitude glaciers. Bamber says, I believe this data is the most reliable estimate of global glacier mass balance that has been produced to date. He noted that 1.4 billion people depend on the rivers that flow from the Himalayas and Tibetan Plateau. Yes, and the further those rivers flow, the nastier they get. Yeah, the Ganges River outside of Kathmandu, Fuji Compuesta, it is really nasty. The new data does not mean that concerns about climate change are overblown in any way. It means there is a much larger uncertainty in high mountain Asia than we thought. Taken globally, all the observations of the Earth's ice, permafrost, Arctic sea ice, snow cover, and glaciers are going in the same direction. GRACE, the satellite system, launched in 2002 and continues to monitor the planet, but it has passed its expected mission span and its batteries are beginning to weaken. A replacement mission has been approved by the U.S. and German space agencies and could launch in 2016. GRACE will go dark before that. This article was amended on February 9th, which was 3 days ago. The original subheading read, melting ice from Asia's peaks is much less than previously estimated. Excuse me while I have a little bit of ice-cold grapefruit juice. Thank you very much. All right. Let's change gears just a little bit. As you make your plans for this year, I know you have been to H&R Block. No, I know it. I get the records here. We see everything here at X Squared Radio. I know that you got some of the money back that you loaned the government tax-free and interest-free. And before you went in and signed away your right to privacy with your 1040 or your EZ 1040, and some of that money is coming back and you're saying, gee, I need this and I need that, but I want you to consider something here. I want you to consider where you want to be on December 21st, 2012. This year. Come on, we've been talking about this for years. We wrote 2,000 pages on the subject. And because of all that work, we have been invited to speak at Chichen Itza with Power Places. December 13th through the 21st, or 22nd actually, I promise to have you home by Christmas. You could be with me at Chichen Itza and my good friends Greg Braden and Maureen St. Germain and other great speakers, great thinkers on this subject of personal enlightenment, empowerment. You want to be part of this world global change? Yes, you do. You might as well be at ground zero. You might as well go with us. It will be a time, not only will you never forget it, but you will come back changed. This is no workshop high. You will come back changed. And I think that's what you're looking for. So I want you to click on the orange banner that says Maya 2012. It's at xsquaredradio.com. I want you to click on that, and I want you to get your deposit in, because I think you need to be there. All right, let's take a quick phone call. Who do we got out there? Cheryl, line one, New Jersey. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Agnew. I enjoy very much your shows. I wanted to ask a quick question, if you knew anything more about these strange metallic boxes, they're 20x5x5, showing up along different coastal areas. They say they have no markings or lettering, and they have no seams, and they can't be moved. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you, Doctor.
Oh, thank you so much, Cheryl. You know, every once in a while we hear something about strange objects dropping out of the sky. I think it was 4 weeks ago, we covered some round objects about the size of a basketball that fell out of the sky. Not unknown metals, just unknown origin. They didn't fall out of an airplane. They had some mild, you know, burning and scorching on them. They made a sonic boom when they came through the air, and they landed on the ground and they were picked up. Not radioactive, nothing inside of them, no moving parts. Now we're getting reports of metal boxes showing up on different coastlines. Maybe they're washing in from a sea container that was dumped over a boat. More and more of these fall off, you know. If you ever go down to the port sometime, watch them do this. Watch one of these container ships come in. It's really fascinating. Because they stack these things about 12 high. Now, these things are 8 feet high, 10 feet wide. Or maybe, no, I'm sorry, they're 10 by 10, and they could be either 40 or 53 feet long. And some of them are short, but most of them are that size. And they're pretty heavy. They contain a lot of weight, and they have a lot of cubic inch inside, and they can be secured with a lock. And they have each individual container has a serial number. But they just stack them on the deck. They don't strap them down. They're just sitting on the deck. Now, they interlock because they kind of have a post at each of the four corners and in the middle, and the next box kind of sits on top of it. It's set there by a crane. Some of these containers have a lot of weight in them, 8, 10,000 pounds, maybe more. Some of them have very little in them, like tennis shoes and clothing, things that don't weigh a lot. They take up a lot of cubic inch. So they're just on the ship and held in place because they're kind of interlocked together like Legos. But these ships oftentimes hit rough seas and high winds because they got to stay on schedule. You know, they leave Shanghai on a Monday. They arrive here, you know, two Mondays later. That's the schedule. It's, you know, like clockwork. And sometimes they face these rogue waves that are just really 75 feet high and 400 miles an hour. And they broadside these ships. They don't show up on radar. They just rise up out of the sea and smack. Well, what happens is, unfortunately, a few of the shipping containers get dumped over the side. And when they do, sometimes they're falling from well over 100 feet high. They smack the water and they bust open and their contents go spilling out on the ocean. Some of those are these metal pieces that can float, and they make their way to different shorelines. Now, I'm not exactly sure if these are the boxes that Cheryl is talking about, but we'll do a little bit of research, Cheryl, and I promise next week I will bring you some information on them, whatever I can find, especially if it's paranormal. I think that would just be really cool. Thank you. Thank you so much for the call from New Jersey. All right. We're trying to develop individual algorithms for each user of phones, cell phones, that can determine specific states of mind. So their location, where they are, their activity, their social context, and who they're with, what they're engaged in, and their mood, says Moore, a researcher for a cell phone company. Now, this is an application, but it's also a cell phone technology. That way, if someone is sitting at home for days on end feeling depressed, the phone could sense it. It can provide them an automated text message or an automated phone call to make a suggestion to give somebody a call or get out of the house, Moore said. Dr. Moore says tests with 8 patients so far have shown that the phone therapist has been helpful in lifting their moods. They all had a major depressive disorder when they started, and they were all both clinically and statistically better at the end of the treatment by the phone. Dr. Moore said that technology could offer more cost-effective ways to treat depression. He plans more widespread tests this summer. What do you think, people? I mean, I like my phone most of the time. And I generally treat my phone pretty well. I don't use it as a hammer. I don't go swimming with it. I make sure it doesn't go through the washer. I make sure it doesn't get scratched or banged up too much. I'm nice to my phone. Generally, I'm pretty pleasant when I'm around my phone. In fact, I get anxious when I'm not around my phone because, you know, I'm a very connected person and I talk to people all over the world. And if I don't talk to people all over the world, I feel like I'm not doing anything. But how much do I care if my phone likes me? I don't know. 888-429-5471. Well, how do you feel about having a puppy phone? I mean, how do you feel about having a girlfriend phone? My gosh, what would happen? Your girlfriend would, or your wife would pick your phone up. Honey, were you depressed today? Your phone's in a really bad mood. It looks here like your phone called you 3 times today to cheer you up. Have I done something, out of the ordinary to make you mad at me? No, you haven't. Then why is your phone doing this? I think the phone doesn't like you. I think the phone only likes me. You see where I'm going with this? I'm writing a script right here, right now. I'm going to stop the program. I'm going to write a script. Phones are getting way too smart. If you have a thought about that, I'd like to hear about it. If you think you need a phone to put you in a better mood, you need a friend. You need a dog. Get a dog. Believe me, it'll cost you less each month. All right. You're going to love this one. From time to time, we've covered stories about congressmen. You know, they're just people, just like we are. Well, mostly, except, you know, they get elected And I guess it's okay because the analog is that they're the House of Commons. They're the working people. The Constitution was set up so that they could serve 2 years and then go home. You know, not really give up their jobs, sort of like serving in the National Guard. But a few congressmen over the years have decided, well, have discovered, that decisions that they make on a daily basis have an effect on businesses down at Main Street. And that if they're really clever, they could buy stock in those businesses. And then when they make that decision to help or hurt that business, they could be helped or hurt by cashing in on the price of the stock. Folks, it ain't rocket science. It's easy to figure out. But some have taken it a little bit too far. For instance, a congressman going out and buying a empty piece of property out in the middle of nowhere that hasn't been farmed, that doesn't have any water, there's no utilities, a road doesn't even go by it. And they go negotiate a price and they buy the property. And then they pass a funding bill that builds a new highway right next to that scrub property, which is now worth millions of dollars. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It has happened. Or a congressman is getting ready to make a decision relative to the FDA that is going to have a negative effect on medical stock that he owns. And so he makes the change, lifts his hand, votes the way he wants to vote, calls his broker, and the broker can then sell the stock, or if he doesn't own the stock, he can buy a put option. In other words, he can bet that the stock's going to go down. And guess what? The stock goes down because the company is severely hurt by that legislation. And thus the congressman benefits. And so his $165,000, $170,000 salary and little perks that he gets for being a congressman, he enters as an ordinary citizen with a slightly higher income than he's used to for a couple of years. And when he returns home 2 or 4 or 6 years later, he's a multimillionaire. Go figure. Well, House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland, said that Congress does not need an official federal budget. Now, we don't need a budget. Just go to the store and buy whatever you want. That's okay. We'll print more. He says because it can just adopt appropriations bills and authorizations policies as needed to keep operating. Translation, we can just print money to keep operating. At a briefing with journalists on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, Hoyer was asked, Mr. Hoyer, around the same time of the State of the Union, I think it was the same day, Republicans were trying to hit Senate Democrats for 1,000 days without passing a budget. And then you talk about this milestone today, 400 days without a jobs bill in the Republican House. But then on Friday, Harry Reid, Democrat, senator, said that he didn't think they needed to bring a budget to the floor this year and that the Budget Control Act served as a guideline. Yeah, it's only a guideline, folks. You don't really have to stick to a budget anyway. It's just a guideline. Hoyer said, what does the budget do? The budget does one thing and really only one thing. It sets the parameters of spending and discretionary caps. Other than that, the Appropriations Committee are not bound by the Budget Committee's priorities. I'm slapping my forehead. He continued, the fact is, you don't need a budget. We can adopt appropriations bills. We can adopt authorizations policies without a budget. We already have an agreed-upon cap on spending. And when we get to it, that's no problem. We'll agree on another cap. Hoyer criticized the Republicans for not passing a budget for a number of years when they were in control of the House, Senate, and the presidency under George Bush. So that this 1,000 days they haven't passed a budget, the Republicans went on for equal lengths of time without passing a budget. I think 05 and 06, Hoyer said. Hoyer called the congressional Republicans highlighting the Senate's failure to pass a budget in over 1,000 days an argument to dissemble and distract the attention on the lack of productive accomplishment in the House of Representatives. Again, I remind you, when we had a Republican president and we controlled the House and Senate, twice as many bills, more than twice as many bills, were signed by President Bush as has been signed by President Obama, Hoyer said. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, why? Because we, congressional Democrats, worked with President Bush, said Hoyer. This Republican leadership is not interested in working with President Obama, and that's unfortunate. The House Republicans passed a budget for fiscal year 2012 back in April 2011. Not one House Democrat supported the bill. Only four House Republicans voted against it. The budget bill went nowhere in the Democrat-controlled Senate. So who's calling the kettle black? The last time the Senate passed a budget was on April 29, 2009. Wow, that's almost 3 years ago. The federal government has been operating on funds approved through a series of continuing resolutions. That's a fancy way of saying procrastination. Raises in the debt ceiling and several appropriations bills. That's sort of like going in your checkbook and adding a couple of zeros behind your $3 balance. Yeah, that's what that's like. The last continuing resolution was passed in mid-December 2011 by both the House and Senate and signed by President Barack Obama, that $915 billion deal, along with several appropriations measures, will keep the federal government operating through the end of fiscal year 2012. We don't need a budget. We don't need no stinking budget. Come on. Gee, we can do this. We can spend. It is not a problem. Don't worry about spending all the money the entire nation has, because we can print more. That's all there is to it. Let's take a quick break, get ourselves back on schedule. It's straight up 9 p.m. Eastern time. X Squared Radio is a three-hour program every Sunday night. Tonight is February 12, 2012. We are clicking down the year 2012, trying to bring you great information every single night. We're covering a tremendous amount of very obscure news that a lot of you would never find. Maybe you find it, but you get a different perspective here, and we appreciate it. At X Squared Radio, everything that goes in comes out positive. That's just the nature of the function. We appreciate you being here with us tonight. We'll play a little Uprising from Muse, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. That was Uprising by Muse. We're glad you're here with us today. We're coming to you live from undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. We appreciate you being part of X Squared Radio tonight. Get ready to plan your year. Don't forget about Maya 2012 coming up. Get your deposits in right away. And also, don't forget about the Pythagoras Conference. You can click on the banner, blue banner. If you don't want to travel to Chichen Itza with me and be down there with the possibility of seeing Sting and Carlos Santana at the same venue at the same time, you don't want to travel outside the country, that's no problem. You can join me at the Pythagoras Conference in southern Indiana. Click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. By the way, you get $100 off if you do that. And that's a heck of a value. 50 speakers. 50 speakers. Go there, check it out. Way affordable because you can drive there. You do not have to fly there. Also, I want you to give a listen to my friend Hans Mittendorf. Hans is not only an artist creating neat artwork, like, you know, album covers, things like that, but he's also a musician, and he creates what's called audio landscapes. It's not really music to sit down and listen to and rock out to, but it's music to meditate to, music to think with, music to study by. And I consider it music to drive by. Hans does a good job with this music. He creates a kind of audio fabric with the music. If you're interested in audio landscape music, I highly recommend Hans Mittendorf. You can find him right at the top of the affiliates column there on the right-hand side of xsquaredradio.com. Click on the actual album cover, the red artwork there to the right, and it will take you to his Amazon page where you can pick up his CDs. Hans Mittendorf. Wavescape Music. Very interesting stuff. You know, the likes of Robert Rich and Eno Deuter. Excellent stuff to listen to. Well, despite media hysterics, oh, by the way, now this story is going to be a little bit controversial. I don't mean it to be. Those of you that that know me know that I care very deeply about the health and welfare of others. In this respect, I have unquestioned integrity, both with areas that I've worked, charities that I've worked with and for and donated to. I spent 10 years with Habitat for Humanity, built a lot of houses, was chairman of construction for Hopkins County. So, you know where my heart is. I was also a speechwriter for Alan Keyes. And in 1996, we had a scheduling conflict. Dr. Keyes had to be somewhere. And so he called me up and said, Brooks, I want you to go give that speech for me. Well, this happened to be at the Lincoln Birthday Fundraiser, Republican fundraiser in Chattanooga, Tennessee. This is a big, big annual event, $250 a plate. So I went, John McCain, Bob Barr, Zach Womp were the other speakers. I was the final speaker. I drew the final straw, and I gave Alan Keyes' speech. So you know where my heart is. This story is about Susan Komen. Susan Komen was a board member for the Breast Cancer Awareness Foundation. The Susan G. Komen Foundation. She was about to defund Planned Parenthood. Both the traditional media outlets and leftist media sites exploded with indignant rage. Hysterical bloggers on the left-wing websites declared that Komen had joined the GOP's war on women and claimed thousands of women would be harmed or even left to die if Komen stopped funding Planned Parenthood. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, my friends. Komen only accounted for 0.055% of the money that Planned Parenthood takes in. Planned Parenthood's their most recent annual report for 2010 fiscal year shows the reproductive health group, and I say that with my tongue in my cheek, took in, I know this is going to blow your mind, Planned Parenthood took in $1.048 billion in revenue. The same report shows that Planned Parenthood took in $18.5 million in excess of revenue over other expenses. That's called profit during the 2010 fiscal year. I thought they were a nonprofit. Oh, yes, they are. Okay, $18.5 million in excess of revenue over expenses. Planned Parenthood also reported that its net assets totaled about $1 billion at the end of 2010 fiscal year. In other words, Planned Parenthood is a billion-dollar, quote, nonprofit that makes millions in profits. By contrast, the amount of funding Susan G. Komen Foundation provided to Planned Parenthood was comparatively small. Komen only provided $680,000 in grants to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood did zero mammograms, zero breast cancer awareness information, nothing to help the Susan G. Komen Foundation. So the resignation, the recent resignation of the VP, who still stands by her desire to cut funding to Planned Parenthood, has decided to resign. Her resignation is a strong statement. Now, I will tell you the facts and nothing but the facts here. I don't have an opinion. I will tell you that I am pro-choice. Let me qualify that. I believe every woman has the right to choose whether to become pregnant or not. no one should make a woman pregnant against her will, period. Okay? Now, recently, you saw that the administration tried to force church-based organizations to comply, to provide not only birth control, but also sterilization and abortions. Why? Well, the reason is simple. 25% of hospitals in the United States are Catholic, and a good portion of them are Mormon. That's right, LDS hospitals, LDS children's hospitals, and they are supported by church members. That's why when you go there, it costs a lot less to get health care, because most of the research and a lot of health care grants are given by these hospitals to people who can't afford health care, and it's great health care. Well, the problem is that they don't provide these reproductive services because they don't want to. They can choose, or they up till recently, choose whether to or not to do anything against their religion at their hospitals. But the White House was trying to force them to do it, and finally he backed down because it's a little difficult to face 50 million Catholics and a couple of million Mormons in the United States. It's just tough. Actually, there's more than that, about 15 million Mormons and about 55 million Catholics in the United States, maybe more. That's a big voting base, liberal and conservative. So he backed off, but then he forced it into the insurance companies. Insurance companies are going to have to cover the costs, and the hospitals will have to provide it, just not pay for it. Now, here's the facts. Approximately 30,000 children are killed every year in Planned Parenthood's abortion mills. 30,000 children. That's a city. That's a city of people. Well, they breathe amniotic fluid at the time, so they can't really speak up for themselves, but evidently they're not covered by our Constitution, so they don't get life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's right up until the time the head clears the womb, because third trimester abortions, this is where the baby is completely delivered, except for the head, or the head comes out and then they just pierce the spinal column at that point and render it lifeless. That's called a third trimester abortion, murder, by better words. In any case, it has nothing to do with the reproductive health of the woman, and I'm only stating facts. The reason it's only 30,000 is because Planned Parenthood is an all cash business. An abortion costs $500 cash. They will accept credit cards, but it is payment before the service is rendered, okay? $500. So 30,000 abortions at $500 a piece. Yeah, you get it. That's a lot of money, okay? Now that the insurance companies will cover that $500 cost, of course, the $500 cost will now go to $750 because, well, you know, it takes a lot of money to process all that insurance paperwork and wait an extra 30 to 90 days for your money, you know, for performing it. But also, the 30,000 deaths each year will jump to 50,000. 50 to 60,000 kids will lose their lives because of this move. And we wonder why our demographics are changing so radically, why we have slipped back to a demographic more like what was here at the end of 1944 than at the end of 2012. It is because of, in large part, due to the activities of Planned Parenthood. Those are the facts. And I believe in my heart that nothing, very, very little that goes on at Planned Parenthood has anything to do with reproductive health or women's health services. Those are code words. It is billion-dollar butchery. That's what it is. All right, now let's change subjects. And if you disagree with me, call 888-429-5471. Trust me, women will not die from having babies. All right, NASA's moon base. NASA is pressing forward on assessing the value of a human-tended waypoint near the far side of the moon. Some people are scratching their heads over this, by the way. How come the far side of the moon? Why not the Earth side of the moon? You know, that way you could kind of look out the window at the Earth in the sky. A little like looking out the window at the moon in the sky. It'd be kind of neat to do. Well, one that would, this one would embrace international partnerships as well as commercial and academic partnerships, space.com has learned. According to a February 3rd memo from William Gerstenmaier, NASA's Associate Administrator for Human Exploration and Operations, a team is being formed to develop a cohesive plan for exploring a spot in space known as the Earth-Moon Libration Point, EML2. Earth-Moon Libration Point. Libration points, also known as Lagrangian points, are places in space where the combined gravitational pull of two large masses roughly balance each other out, kind of a place of equilibrium that would allow spacecraft to essentially park there in space. And this is a pre-memo NASA appraisal of EML2, which is near the lunar far side, has spotlighted this destination as the leading option for a near-term exploration capability. EML2 could serve as a gateway for capability-driven exploration of multiple destinations, such as near lunar space, asteroids, the moon, the moons of Mars, and ultimately Mars itself, according to NASA officials. A capabilities-driven NASA architecture is one that should use the agency's planned heavy lift rocket known as the Space Launch System and the Orion multi-purpose crew vehicle as the foundation elements. Now, the reason that they want to use the far side of the moon is not so that they would be sequestered away from the view of the Earth. The far side of the moon would lend itself to easy launches to space because you wouldn't have the Earth's gravitational pull pulling away from you. You'd have it another few thousand miles behind you. You'd have the moon. So the memo spells out six strategic principles to help enable exploration beyond low Earth orbit. First, incorporating significant international participation. Obviously, that's important because it costs too much for one country to do it by themselves. U.S. commercial business opportunities. We need factories. We need industrial use of the moon, something that you can make profit with, like mining of H3 or titanium or precious metals. Multi-use or reusable in-space infrastructure. So we can land on the moon and take off from the moon. We don't have to discard things in space. The application of technologies for near-term applications while focusing research and development of new technologies to reduce costs, improve safety, and increase mission capture over the longer term. Demonstrated affordability and near-term mission opportunities. Well-defined cadence of compelling missions providing for an incremental buildup of capabilities to perform more complex missions over time. A lot of those would be military in nature. According to the strategic planners of EML, they were looking for a quiet zone, which could enable significant telerobotic science on the far side of the moon and can serve as a platform for solar and Earth scientific observation, radio astronomy, and other science in the quiet zone behind the moon. I mean, come on, people. Between satellite TV, cell phones, all kinds of radio activity going on the Earth, the Earth side of the moon is the noisy side of the moon. You remember from the movie, don't you? Yes, when the capsule with the astronauts in it went around the other side of the moon, they lost communication. That's because the moon shields that side of the planet from radio waves. So it's a nice, quiet place to take careful views of deep space without the interference from Earth. That's why we just can't see stuff from here. We can't take gravitational wave measurements from here very easily. Well, we will be able to. We'll talk about that in the last hour. But the idea is that it's the quiet side of the moon. So Gerstenmaier noted that moving forward on international, commercial, and academic partnerships will require significant detailed development and integration. That's a long way of saying it's going to take money and it's going to take resources. And we want it to be multinational so that we can spread out the risk. Okay? He is bullish on the promise of telerobotic exploration of the moon. That means that we can run robots from here. We don't have to have people out there running heavy equipment on the moon. We can run that stuff from here or run it from space. Burns and his team have been collaborating with Lockheed Martin, you know, Skunk Works, for more than a year to plan an early Orion mission that would go into a halo orbit of EML-2 above the lunar far side. This is extremely exciting from both the explorations and science sides, and I'm excited about it as well. I was excited about it when it was first announced. They want to have roads on the moon. In a Lunar Center white paper provided, researchers noted that EML-2 mission would have astronauts traveling 15% farther from Earth than did the Apollo astronauts and spending almost three times longer in deep space. Such missions would validate the Orion spacecraft's life support system for short durations, could demonstrate the high-speed reentry capability needed for return to Earth from deep space, and could help scientists gauge astronauts' radiation dose from cosmic rays and solar flares. Obviously, if they would have taken the advice of this program, they would have built the lunar bases below the surface of the moon, and then they would not be exposed to that kind of radiation. You know, we have talked about habitations on Mars. They're testing them now in some of the more hostile areas of the planet. And they look pretty cool. It looked like just about like what you saw in the movie Pitch Black, similar to that. You might want to go online and take a look at them. They can take all the garbage and compact it into discs and, you know, use it on the outside for radiation. So radiation protection. I would suggest taking things that don't make trash, but, you know, what? Who am I? Just freeze dry your food and put it in as thin a wrapper as possible. Some of the stuff is going to be wasted because there has to be labeling and instructions and all of that. And they would have to reinforce the habitat against outside elements. On Mars, of course, you're going to get wind, but on the moon, you're going to get these little micrometeorites like salt coming in at 18,000 miles an hour. Astronomers said Wednesday that there are 100 billion planets out there in the Milky Way. And Earth probably has a companion planet out there. Planets are the rule rather than the exception, said lead astronomer Arnaud de Cassan at the Institute of Astrophysics in Paris. He led an international team of 42 scientists who spent 6 years surveying millions of stars at the heart of the Milky Way in the most comprehensive effort yet to gauge the prevalence of planets in the galaxy. To estimate the number of alien worlds, Dr. Cassan and his colleagues studied 100 million stars between 3,000 and 25,000 light years from Earth with a technique called gravitational microlensing. We've talked about that on this program before. It uses distant light amplified by the gravity of a massive star or planet to create an astronomical magnifying lens. Then they combined their findings with their earlier surveys, which used other detection techniques, to create a statistical sample of stars and the planets that orbit them, which they say is representative of the galaxy. By their calculation, most of the Milky Way's stars, 100 billion is the most conservative estimate, have planets. The researchers reported in Nature Wednesday. None of the alien planets detected so far appear suitable for conventional carbon-based life form like we have here on Earth, but almost two-thirds of the stars likely host a planet slightly larger than Earth, measuring about five times its mass, and a half of them harbor a planet about the mass of Neptune. About one-fifth of them are home to a gas giant like Jupiter or larger. One can point at almost any random star and say there are planets orbiting that star. Well, that makes a lot of sense, Dr. Cassan. One of the things that you're discounting here is that the vast majority of planets, not stars, but the vast majority of planets in the galaxy are free-floating. That is to say, they don't revolve around any star. They're just zipping through the cold blackness of space on their own. Moreover, millions of these planets may circle two stars in an arrangement considered so unlikely until a few months ago. It was found only in science fiction. Science fiction wins out again. Way to go. Astronomers using NASA's Kepler Space Telescope announced in a separate finding published online in the magazine Nature on Wednesday. We are starting to see a whole new type of planetary system, which is unlike anything in our own solar system, said astronomer William Welsh at San Diego State University, who presented the Kepler findings Wednesday at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Austin, Texas. These discoveries are the latest from an avalanche of new data about worlds around other stars. Boy, that just gives a whole new meaning to summer, doesn't it? You know, we're revolving around this star for this period of time, and then we kind of fall into a, maybe not a figure eight, maybe a giant oval. We fall into an orbit around another star with a totally different climate, and then back again. It would seem like a very hostile type of planet to any kind of life. Just when the grass started growing and getting green again, the next star comes along and just cooks the stuff in the front yard. Well, wait a minute. That already happens on our planet. Oh, that's right. Well, anyway, since 1994, researchers have confirmed the existence of more than 700 alien planets around various stars, with more than 2,000 additional candidates currently under study by astronomers around the world. Earlier this month, astronomers using the Hungarian-made automated telescope network announced the discovery of four more massive alien worlds, each one orbiting a separate star. Confirmation requires different methods from those used in Dr. Kassan's estimates. And they probably use perturbation theory, where they're looking at the gravitational wiggle of the star rather than the light lensing. John Southwart at UK's Keele University, who's part of the research projects, he said, "We are now facing the idea that planets are all over the place." Imagine that. Just a few years ago, we thought we were the only planet in the Milky Way, and boom, there you go. Planets all over the place. Good job, science fiction. What a great job you guys do out there creating these stories out of nothing. And then we start looking out into space and we find it. There it is, just like you saw it when you made up your words ignominiously on your little laptop. Astronomers using the Kepler Space Telescope found the first known double star planet just last September. Kepler-16, a gassy oddball orb the size of Saturn that circles a pair of stars 200 light-years from Earth, like the planet Tatooine in the Star Wars films. You remember. Come on, I can recall the scene. Da, 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 da. Come on. You know, when Luke walks out, they're the moisture farmers, and he walks out and he looks up and he sees the two stars in the distance. There you go. On Wednesday, Dr. Welsh and his colleagues announced that they have confirmed the existence of two more alien worlds in distinctive double star solar systems in the constellation Cygnus. The first, called Kepler 34b, orbits its two small stars in a solar system about 4,900 light years from Earth. Wow, that'll take a while to get there. Sorry, need another swallow of grapefruit juice here. Both planets are fluffy, gaseous, Saturn-sized worlds where temperatures quickly rise and fall from balmy to near boiling as the planets periodically swing close to their stars and then spin away in an elliptical orbital minuet. Fermilab. Oh, this is good stuff. How many of you out there know about the hologram of the universe? Ah, very good, very good. A lot of you have heard about this. Well, here's the science behind it. You're going to like this. This is really cool. Fermilab particle astrophysicist Craig Hogan made waves with a mind-boggling proposition. Okay, are you ready to have your mind boggled? We especially like to do boggling of the mind here at X Squared Radio. It's one of my favorite things to do, is to boggle people. The 3D universe in which we appear to live, that in itself is a pretty peculiar statement, is no more than a hologram. Well, there you have it. Pretty cool, huh? Oh, no, there's more. Now he is building the most precise clock of all time to directly measure whether our reality is an illusion. The idea that space-time may not be entirely smooth, like a digital image that becomes increasingly pixelated as you zoom in. You know, 10 years ago, nobody would have known what I just said. Nobody would have known. Very few people would have known what pixelation means. Yeah, come on. We were using film, most of us. Digital has taken over everything. I don't even know if you can buy 35-millimeter film. I suppose you can. There are a lot of cameras out there. But they don't do nearly as good a job. Anyway, it had been previously proposed by Stephen Hawking and others that space may not be entirely smooth because it's made of space-time. Possible evidence for this model appeared last year in the unaccountable noise plaguing the GEO-600 experiment in Germany. You know, this is a an interferometer that they built. They searched for gravitational waves from black holes. To Hogan, the jitteriness suggested that the experiment had stumbled upon the lower limit of the space-time pixels resolution. Black hole physics, in which space and time become compressed, provides a basis for math, showing that the third dimension really might not exist at all. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of people really upset about this because they're really 3D. You know what I'm talking about? They want to be in control. They want to own everything in this dimension. I'm saying, yeah, so what? In this two-dimensional cartoon of a universe, what we perceive as a third dimension would actually be a projection of time intertwined with depth. If this is true, the illusion can only be maintained until equipment becomes sensitive enough to find its limits. That'll be a shocker, won't it? Hogan goes on to say, you can't perceive it because nothing ever travels faster than light. This holographic view is how the universe would look if you sat on a photon. Wow. Must have listened to this program last month. Not everyone agrees with this idea. Well, we do. Its foundation is formed with math rather than hard data, as it is common in theoretical physics. And although a holographic universe would answer many questions about black hole physics and other paradoxes, it clashes with classical geometry. Oh, you have no idea. We're going to talk about that. Which demands a universe of smooth, continuous paths in space and time. So Hogan says, so we want to build a machine which would be the most sensitive measurement ever made of space-time itself. That is the holometer. Are you ready for this? No, it's not that kind of, it doesn't measure holes, okay? It's not like measuring the hole in a donut. We're talking about holometry or a hologram, okay? A hologram is a 3D image of something that can be created by bringing photons in from three different angles. You know what a hologram is. Well, a holometer isn't something that we just invented. It was actually thought of a long time ago. The holometer is named after a 17th century surveyor's instrument. Now, I wonder what he saw in his dream when he created this. The name holometer was first used for a surveying device created in the 17th century, an instrument for the taking of all measures, both on the earth and in the heavens. That's a quote, people. 17th century, Hogan felt this fit with the mission of his holographic interferometer, which is currently being developed at Fermilab's largest laser lab. You know, in a classical interferometer, by the way, this was first developed in the late 1800s with a specific job of determining whether the speed of light was actually constant in space. We thought that the Earth, you know, traveling at 18.5 miles per second around the sun, if you fired a laser beam off the front end of the Earth, you know, in toward the orbit's front, and you fired a laser beam off the back end of the Earth, you know, kind of like off the trunk lid of the Earth as you're going around the orbit, that the two light beams would differ in speed. Well, we had to prove it. I mean, come on, we just had to. So we built a interferometer. It looks like a giant framing square. One light beam and the other light beam are absolutely identical because they're made by splitting a single light beam using a half covered mirror. So part of the light beam is reflected and part of the light beam goes through. Well, it goes down to other mirrors, bounces off and comes back at slightly half a wavelength out of phase with one another. So that when they're aimed at each other, they interfere with one another. And in that interference is a quiet spot, like a black dot, and it can be used to measure changes in space-time, can be used to measure changes in speed, vibrations. So that's why it was developed. That's what an interferometer is. Anyway, it was built in the 1800s. A laser beam in a vacuum tube hits a mirror called a beam splitter, which breaks it in two. The two beams travel at different angles down lengths of two vacuum pipe arms before hitting mirrors at the end, bouncing back to the beam splitter. Now, the biggest one is in Hanford, Washington. The tubes are 4 kilometers long, and the light beams make about 75 trips down and back before running into the detector. So that's a very, very long laser beam for something that's built here on Earth. Now, keep in mind, the tube's 4 kilometers long. Earth is round, you know. We discovered that a long time ago, before the 18th century. So the tube starts out at ground level near the splitter, and as you get out toward the end, it's quite a distance off the ground because it's not just, you know, like a highway. It's a flat highway, not a round highway. So we're building it flat, not like flat space-time. That's what we're measuring. Yes, you can use a flat ruler to measure things in a curved space-time. This is how it's done. Now, the holometer's precision means that it doesn't have to be large. It doesn't have to be 4 kilometers long. It only needs to be 40 meters in length. Yeah, 40 meters. That's way shorter than a football field. And it's only 1/100th the size of current interferometers, which measure gravitational waves from black holes and supernovas, also coalescing neutron stars. Yet, because the space-time frequencies it measures are so rapid, it would be more precise over very short time intervals by 7 orders of magnitude, that's 7 zeros, than any atomic clock in existence. The shaking or vibration of space-time occurs at 1,000,000 times per second. That's not so fast. That's way slower than a cell phone. And probably only slightly faster than most people can text on a cell phone. Anyway, 1,000,000 times per second, 1,000 times what your ear can hear. Yes, you wouldn't be able to hear it, said Fermilab experimental physicist Aaron Chow, whose lab is developing prototypes for the holometer. Matter doesn't like to shake at that speed. You could listen to gravitational frequencies with headphones. The whole trick, Chow says, is to prove that the vibrations don't come from the instrument. Using technology similar to that in noise cancellation headphones, sensors outside the instrument detect vibrations and shake the mirror at the same frequency, slightly out of phase, to cancel them. Any remaining shakiness at high frequency, the researchers propose, will be evidence of blurriness in space-time. Well, obviously, the vibrations that they're going to pick up from Earth. Hold on one moment while I take another sip. The vibrations will come from things like earth tremors, waves, wind, trucks driving by, that kind of stuff. We can tune that out at a much, much, much lower frequency. And then the shakiness of space, upwards of 1 megahertz, would be free to vibrate without any kind of interference. With the holometer's long arms, we're magnifying space-time's uncertainty, Chow said. Now, the difference between this interferometer and the gravitational wave interferometers is that these are twins. They're not separated by several thousand miles, the way the one in Hanford and the one in Livingston, Louisiana are. These are on top of one another, and so they have sort of a stereographic look. Hogan's team liked the holometer idea so much, they decided to build two of them, one on top of the other. The machines can confirm one another's measurements. This month, having successfully built a 1 meter prototype of the 40 meter arm, they will weld the parts of the first of the vacuum arms together. I imagine if that's going to be in a museum somewhere, this 1 meter unit. People trying to tie reality together don't have any data, just a lot of beautiful math, said Hogan. The hope is that this gives them something to work with. Now, this is located in Illinois. It is the world's most sensitive laser interferometer when it's complete. It will surpass the sensitivity of the GO600. The GO600, just so you have your memory refreshed, is a gravitational wave detector located near Sarzedt, Germany. This instrument and its sister interferometric detectors, when operational, are some of the most sensitive gravitational wave detectors ever designed. It's true. They are designed to detect relative changes in distance, vibrations, on the order of 1 part in 10^-21 centimeters. This is very, very small, about a fraction of a proton. That's very, very small vibrations. The holometer also surpasses, by doing so, the sensitivity of the LIGO systems. LIGO means Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories. There are two of them in this country, one in Hanford, Washington, where it's very geotechnically quiet, and the other one is in Livingston, Louisiana. I've been to both of them. Quite spectacular facilities. I highly recommend, if you are within a couple hundred miles of these ever, that you go and take a tour, because it is fascinating. Now, when a gravitational wave passes through the interferometer, the space-time in the local area is altered. It warps. It bends, sort of like grabbing the bed sheet and giving it a yank. Depending on the source of the wave and its polarization, this results in an effective change in length of one or both of the cavities. That's how it works. After an equivalent of approximately 75 trips down this 4-kilometer tube I just told you about, then it hits the beam splitter and it's measured. There, it's quite fascinating. It's so large, it boggles the mind to stand at the beam splitter and look down the tube and realize that you cannot, with the naked eye, see the end of the tube. That is really fascinating. The reason that these things are so amazing, and they were originally designed by Dr. Kip Thorne, and they were built with government money over a series of years. It takes about $100 million a year to keep these babies running. They were recently upgraded. This year, they're both going to be operational at the same time, which is kind of a rare thing. And they're going to be tied together to kind of give us a stereographic look of space. But they're trying to get down quieter and quieter, and they do this through a series of modifications. First thing they do, of course, is control the laser itself. Because, you know, lasers are a single wavelength, often polarized light. That is to say, all the waves are stacked to be parallel to one another. So it's not a tube of light. It's more like a bunch of pieces of paper stacked together. And the other thing is to actually control the frequency. Because, you know, all electronics have a little bit of vibration to them, up and down. We don't pay much attention to it unless you're building an instrument of this sensitivity, then you notice it. That frequency has to be locked on, I mean, within a fraction of a nanometer. A nanometer is a 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. So we're talking pretty dang small here. So once you are able to control the actual light source itself, and this can be changes in temperature have to be controlled, earth vibrations, fluctuations in the power supply, all that stuff have to be filtered out and controlled. The other thing is, of course, all the air has to be removed in the tube so there's no diffraction taking place as these lasers are going down and back, down and back, down and back 75 times. The other thing is that the mirrors, the sapphire smooth mirrors at the other end, need to be vibration free. They do this by affixing them to heavy weights, like a 1-ton weights. And then that weight is suspended by wire from a very, very vibration isolated structure. Why wire? Well, the reason is that if there is some vibration in the structure, even though it's, you know, bolted to the ground on an independent slab, floating on springs, that kind of thing, the vibrations are still going to be there. As infinitesimal as they are, they're going to be there in the nature of, you know, a couple of atoms of vibration. But that those vibrations cannot travel down the wires to this very heavy weight that is effectively suspended in space. Even if the vibrations did go down these thin wires, it's not going to transfer to the big weight, whose inertia, that is to say its resistance to movement, is so high that the wires cannot move it. And so that's how the mirrors are kept very, very quiet. So those two modifications have allowed them to get down to 10 to the minus 21 centimeters, or 10 in inverse centimeters. Very, very, very small. However, there is something smaller. It's called a Planck unit, okay? Max Planck was the guy that came up with this, and a set of constants that go with it. There are five of them. I'm going to talk about them just a little bit here so that you can be a better armchair theoretical physicist. Are you ready? Hold on. No, there won't be an exam. But thanks for the question. In physics, Planck units are physical units of measurement, sort of like the marks on a tape measure or the digits on a micrometer. Units of measurement. These are defined exclusively in terms of five universal physical constants. Okay, the reason we do that is we don't want to use natural units. Natural units are units, you know, based on the length of a king's thumb or the length of the king's thigh, some kind of anthropomorphic measurement. These are measured in terms of mathematics only. So there are five of these. One is a gravitational constant. The other is the reduced Planck constant. The other is the speed of light in a vacuum, also constant. The other is a Coulomb constant, sometimes called K. And the other is Boltzmann's constant. Okay, they're used in different formulas for different things. I'm going to explain it. Don't worry. Everything's under control. You can loosen your seatbelt a little bit, but definitely keep your arms inside the vehicle. You can recline your chair and look out the window, but I promise you're going to have a better understanding here when we get done. Now, physicists sometimes refer to Planck units as God's units. The reason they do that is because there's nothing smaller. Yeah, you just can't get any smaller. I'll explain. Planck units are free of the anthropocentric arbitrariness. That's, we are arbitrary beings in the universe, but, you know, a horse is 17 hands high. You get it? Okay. An inch, meter, you got it. Okay. All of those measurements are anthropocentric, which is means they're based on humans' interpretation. Planck units are based on mathematics. Some physicists argue that communication with extraterrestrial intelligence would have to employ such a system of units in order to be understood. Unlike the meter and the second, you know, remember when watching Battlestar Galactica, the old version of it, the one that came out on the TV in the 70s, we talked about centons and millicentons, you know, where minutes were not broken into 60 seconds. They were broken into 100 units. That makes a lot more sense. It's a whole bunch easier to work with than the second. But unlike the meter and the second, which exists as fundamental units in the SI system for human historical reasons, we won't go into right now because we don't have enough time, the Planck length and Planck time are conceptually linked at a fundamental physical level. All systems of measurement feature base units. Like in the International System of Units, which we also call SI, for example, the base unit of length is the meter. You know, we have meters, we have kilometers, we have centimeters and millimeters and micrometers. Everything's based on the meter. In the system of Planck units, the Planck base unit of length is simply known as the Planck length. The base unit of time is the Planck time, and so on. These units are derived from the five-dimensional universal physical constants. All right. Now, there will be an exam on this, so you might want to write this down. This is the way the universe exists. It is measured. And this is why the universe is not infinite. Because you cannot have an infinite universe when you have a finite measurement system. Nothing can be any shorter than a Planck length. And I'll explain that in a moment. A Planck length, Max Planck came up with this. It is 1.616. Sound pretty close to the golden mean to you? 1.618? 1.616 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. Now, that's a lot smaller than 10 to the minus 21 centimeters. Very small. Very small. If the holometer can measure down to a Planck length, it will be a little like listening to a heartbeat with a stethoscope instead of on the other side of a football field. Big difference. Okay, a Planck mass is 2.176 times 10 to the minus 8 kilograms. Planck time is 5.391 times 10 to the minus 44 seconds. This has to do with a wavelength, by the way. Planck charge is 1.875 times 10 to the minus 18th coulombs, and a Planck temperature is 1.416 times 10 to the 32 kelvins. Kelvin is 273 degrees less than Celsius. That's what absolute zero would be measured from, you know, absolute zero on up. So room temperature is somewhere around 273 degrees Kelvin. There you go. Now, this is why the universe is not finite, as I said. When you have a finite measuring system, there is no possibility for an infinite universe. Fermilab stated, everyone is familiar these days with the blurry and pixelated images or noisy sound transmission associated with poor internet bandwidth. Nothing like you get here at BBS Radio. You get perfectly crisp, clear internet webcast radio here at BBS Radio because we have the highest available technology on the planet. Well, the holometer seeks to detect the equivalent blurriness of noise in reality itself associated with the ultimate frequency limit imposed by nature. Craig Hogan at Fermilab stated about the experiment, what we're looking for is when the lasers lose step with each other. In other words, a difference between the two lasers that are split. We're trying to detect the smallest unit in the universe. Now, it's one thing to think about it and theorize it. You are now empowered to measure. The very smallest things in the universe, if you can get your hands on them. But now we're talking about detecting the smallest unit in the universe. It's really fun. It's sort of old-fashioned physics experiment where you don't know what the results will be till you make your measurements. Like, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this? Experimental physicist Hartmut Grote of the Max Planck Institute in Germany states that although he is skeptical that the apparatus will successfully detect the holographic fluctuations if the experiment is successful, it would be a very strong impact to one of the most open questions in fundamental physics. It would be the first proof that space-time, the fabric of the universe, is measurable. How about that? The fluctuations in space-time, also called the fabric of space-time, being rippled by intense gravity located in a small space, like you would have with a coalescing neutron star or hopefully with black holes. We haven't actually directly measured any black holes yet, but we still keep the theory alive. Neutron stars are already exotic matter formed by suns that are about four or five times the mass of our sun that burn out. They lose the battle with gravity, and the electrons are collapsed onto the protons, making them neutrons, right? Plus one and minus one added together gives you zero. That's the neutron. Also, all the hydrogen, all the helium, and all the carbon have been either consumed or have turned to neutrons, which are formed during the fusion process of those stars. They're already quite dense and looking for other dense bodies in space with which to coalesce or come together like dancers. They rarely hit head on, but they rather come together like, well, like two nickels spinning their way down one of those, you know, tornado-looking cones at the mall when you put two nickels in them. They sort of dance around each other, spinning faster and faster and faster and faster as they reduce their orbits around each other. As they do this, because they're so dense, they actually ripple space-time. And those ripples may travel up to 20 times the speed of light through space. The fabric forms the pathway for light when it travels through space as a wave. So if space-time is being rippled, then the pathway of light ripples as well. You remember how we discovered that. Well, at first it was theorized by Einstein. Then we waited for a complete solar eclipse, and we waited for starlight to come from a set of stars that we knew were behind the sun that was now eclipsed by the moon, and we knew it precisely when they would pass the limb of the sun and be visible. And guess what? The light of those stars showed up early. Einstein was right. The gravity of the sun was warping space-time, and the light from those stars way on the other side of the sun bent around the gravitational ripple of the sun and made it to Earth early, before those stars were actually in line with where we should have seen them from Earth. Quite the vindication. All right, the hypothesis that holographic noise may be observed in this manner has been criticized on the grounds that the theoretical framework used to derive the noise violates Lorentz invariance. Now, Lorentz invariance violation is our very strongly constrained already, an issue that I will discuss right now. Because, the Lorentz invariance is really a common mistake. People that aren't trained or don't know, they call it a Lorentz invariance. It's actually called a covariance, not invariance. In standard physics, Lorentz symmetry is the feature of nature that says this: experimental results are independent of the orientation of the boost velocity of the laboratory through space. Okay? Bottom line is, to make it simple, there is no place at rest in space, okay? We all know that. There's no place that you can go, okay, I'm standing perfectly still. because the solar system is moving through space and Earth is moving through its orbit and the laboratory that's sitting on the Earth is moving through orbit. And so we have a Lorentz symmetry that says experimental results are independent of the orientation or boost velocity of the laboratory through space. Now, that's why it makes it pretty hard to measure space while you're in it. Theoretically, we can step outside the universe and we can look at the universe as a finite body and we can say things about it and not hurt its feelings too much. Well, anyway, I'm going to get into a little bit more complexity here, and so I need to take a quick break. Not that we do any commercials, but it allows people to break this up into bites on their podcasting so that they can take a breath. So we'll take a very quick break, listen to a little Enigma, Goodbye Milky Way. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Thank you.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. As you're making your plans for the year, I think it would be a very smart idea if you went to Maya 2012, the orange banner there on X Squared Radio. Click on it. Join me down at Chichen Itza, ground zero, for the entire Maya story. Some of the best speakers in the world are going to be there. My friend Maureen St. Germain and my master for meditation. Also, Greg Braden and others. Check it out, Maya 2012. I know that that's where you want to be. From the 13th to the 22nd of December, I promise to have you home for Christmas, and you will tell stories that will keep your family entertained for a long, long time. Okay, let me get back to this Lorentz covariance. Just a little bit of physics so that you can understand how important this holometer is. It can be a little counterintuitive, which means that knowing what we know now, they don't make sense. Sort of like dropping a ball from 6 feet to the ground and expecting it to fall upward instead of down. Okay, that's counterintuitive. Knowing what we know, we know how things are going to work out. But this is a little counterintuitive, and we're just dying to prove it. While high-energy accelerators have traditionally been designed to probe fundamental particles at ever smaller microscopic scales, it has been known for some time that data from many such experiments could contain information about weak Lorentz-violating background fields that exist in space on scales the size of the solar system and greater. Among the basic signals being sought are sidereal, that's sideways variations, arising due to the rotation of the Earth around the Sun, and also relative to the fixed background stars. You know, many, many physicists believe that this relativity, I'm one of them, us compared to the fabric of the universe, we're in motion. So it's difficult to measure something that is very, very small when you're already in motion. It's sort of like trying to listen to the stereo in your car when your muffler goes bad. You have a lot of background noise. You just cannot hear the finer points. And unfortunately, when you're listening to something very, very, very quiet, like 10 to the minus 30th negative centimeters, you need very, very quiet conditions. So this covariance is a related concept, okay? It's based on a physical quantity, and it's also an equation. And I'm not going to go into all the details there because we have a couple callers stacked up, and I want to take them. But the holometer has been criticized because it makes it possible something that we never thought would be possible. And remember, it's only possible, not probable, for a key property to be different in two different frames of reference. If it happens, then the holometer can measure that difference, and we will be on to the next step in understanding time and space. And once we understand it, we should be able to go through it, which means maybe superluminal travel, understanding consciousness, and other things like that might be possible. And there are all kinds of patterns and arrangements and harmonics that appear in this that are very significant. It shows up in sacred geometry. It shows up in number patterns. It shows up in consciousness mirrors that we build in inside ourselves on top of these harmonics. It has significance in all kinds of regions, not just in physics, but also in understanding human consciousness. Now, I'm sure you get all this the first time through. The significance is that we once thought that lasers would bend slightly when gravitational waves made by spinning dense bodies in space would go by. We just knew it. We learned that this was correct. But we also learned that 10 to the minus 21 negative centimeters is not enough. With a few $100 million, we got down to that. We actually got down to 10 to the minus 23rd. and we could measure the ripples. We also discovered particles blinking into our dimension from another dimension. Now, we always theorized that. We always wondered about it, and some in private, because, you know, we didn't really have empirical data to prove it. But Stephen Hawking got into one of the arguments of his lifetime. It lasted a long, long time. About at the edge of black holes, photons can clone themselves and lose one of the clones into the black hole. He actually theorized that our universe is leaking into another universe. And of course, yes, the inverse is true. There's probably particles, information, leaking into our universe from another universe. And what we wrote about in Volume 1 of The Arc of Millions of Years way back in 2004 has now been proven true, or at least a very solid theory now. We have empirical evidence to back up our original theory that universes exist like bubbles in space and in bubble clusters. We don't know what's in between them. We think that it's actually void, which just the act of defining it means that it's not void. But theoretically, there's a space between the universes, and that universes are connected together through these supermassive spinning black holes, which means that each galaxy is like a gateway to another universe. But these are only theories, and now the data is starting to stack up that says, hey, you know, we might have something here. The holometer is going to give us a million times more sensitivity to be able to measure something in two frames of reference. That's serious. That's serious. Now, I was just kidding. There's not going to be an exam at the end of this broadcast, but you can go back and listen to it and you can fill in the pieces. It's pretty wild, but it didn't really surprise anyone much. Okay, we expected it. We expected to find particles blinking into our dimension from another dimension. What I didn't expect was Dr. Fred Robb telling it to me, saying it to me at the Hanford Interferometer, the LIGO in Hanford. There was no other explanation for some behaviors of electromagnetism, but we weren't sure until the LIGO detected them. Now, we need something with much more resolution, sort of like using a micrometer instead of a tape measure to tell how thick something is. We need more resolution. The holometer can detect these things about a million times smaller than the smallest thing LIGO can sense. Zooming in that small, we should be able to see the universe vibrating. This is where we will see just how much we can get past these Lorentz limitations. It isn't that it's a covariance. It's not that we're in violation of it. We're moving past it because we're able to use those Planck constants that I shared with you before, those incredibly tiny increments of measurement. They're now no longer just mathematically convenient. They're physically significant. It isn't that we are going to go that small. It is that when it works, when this works, we will be able to see the big picture. That's what's important about this holometer, and we support it. I also support the idea that the thing's only 400 meters long. That's great. You can almost fit that inside of a large building, although they'll probably use a significant amount of real estate to build this thing. And the nicest thing about it is it probably doesn't have any military applications. Isn't that cool? Unless we're going to build a transporter to sneak inside our enemy's facilities. Hey, it's possible, just not probable. So let's bring ourselves around to that. Maybe we'll finish up with this. You know, recently the White House has grounded NASA. That's not a pretty thing, okay? The budget came in on Monday from Obama. The administration will send the NASA division that launches rovers to Mars and probes to Jupiter crashing back to Earth. It's done. Scientists briefed on the proposed budget said that the president's plan drops funding for planetary science at NASA from $1.5 billion this year to $1.2 billion next year, with further cuts continuing through 2017. It would eat at NASA's Mars exploration program, which after two high-profile failures in 1999, that was a long time ago, we had some successes since then, You remember the first one was the beagle that splatted into the surface of the moon or Mars because the Brits forgot to make the conversion between metric and standard. Yeah, go figure. Anyway, we're doing all this great science, and we're taking the public along with us. And that's my buddy Jim Bell, an Arizona State University scientist, a former manager of the Mars rover Opportunity. Pulling the rug out from under it is going to really be devastating. If it's approved, the president's budget will sever NASA's partnership with the European Space Agency to send probes to Mars in 2016 and 2018. Agreed upon in 2009, NASA was to pay $1.4 billion and the Europeans $1.2 billion for the two missions. In an email, NASA spokesman David Weaver wrote, "Consistent with the tough choices being made across the federal government, NASA is reassessing its current Mars exploration initiatives to maximize what can be achieved scientifically, technologically, and in support of our future human missions." Okay, translation, the check is in the mail. And I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. A congressional champion of space exploration said that the budget slashing absolutely will not fly with the House committee that oversees NASA. You don't cut spending for critical scientific research endeavors that have immeasurable benefit to the nation and inspire the human spirit of exploration we all have. That's our Republican buddy John Abney Culberson from Texas. Last fall, NASA handed out $46 million to contractors to begin building instruments for the 2016 mission. But earlier this week, Alvaro Jimenez, top scientist at the European agency, told the BBC that NASA's continued participation in the partnership was highly unlikely. The impact of the cuts will be to immediately terminate the Mars deal with the Europeans, said G. Scott Hubbard, a Stanford University and former NASA planetary scientist who revived the agency's Mars exploration program after the 1999 failures. And the Russians have had their problems too. You know, they've had three missions to Phobos foiled. One, somebody on the team inadvertently turned the darn thing off after it was launched and almost at its location. Terrible thing because they couldn't turn it back on. The second one made it, orbited a few times, took some photographs, and was shot out of the sky by a missile. Yeah, and they got it on film. Of course, they didn't share it for a couple of years, but once they shared it, it clearly showed a missile headed right for a little tiny satellite orbiting the moon of Phobos and shot it right out of the sky. So the Russians, excited about it, built another one and launched it. And when it went around the dark side of the Earth, they lost communication with it and somebody killed it. It recently fell back to Earth, by the way. This is a scientific tragedy and a national embarrassment. The 2016 mission, called the Trace Gas Orbiter, was to sniff the Martian atmosphere for methane, which, as you know, is a byproduct of respiration. We would have been able to tell if there was life on Mars. With austere budgets, that is budget cutting, expected across the federal government, NASA is finding itself squeezed. Last year, Congress ordered the agency to build a giant new rocket and a deep space crew capsule. Congress also told the agency to finish the over-budgeted James Webb Space Telescope, now expected to launch no earlier than 2018. The executive branch's budget request, unveiled every February, is used by federal agencies to set spending priorities. Yeah, NASA has to have a budget, but Congress doesn't need one. Go figure. And what happens every February, actually earlier than that, is all our friends down at NASA head up to Washington, and they make their great PowerPoint presentations talking about all the successes they've had and all the successes they want to have, and it falls on very excited ears at Congress, and then the committee heads take out the chainsaws. In other words, they want to spend their money on other things. Well, it doesn't go over very well everywhere. And one of the places it doesn't go well is, well, I'm just going to play a little news clip here for you. You'll get the idea of what's going on up there. It's pretty, I'm going to use the word disgusting for science. Here we go.
The buzz around NASA this week is that the Planetary Science Program is going to take a 20% budget cut next year. That means less money to explore other planets, especially Mars. A writer for Time explains. With limited money for science and an over-budget new space telescope, the space agency essentially had to make a choice in where it wanted to explore, the neighboring planet or the far-off cosmos. Mars lost. Last September, NASA's former Associate Administrator for Science, Edward Wheeler, resigned because of the coming budget cuts. He said he was tired of fighting NASA's budget office to try to save the Mars programs. Fox News has his comments.
He says, to me, it's totally irrational and unjustified. We're the only country on this planet that has the demonstrated ability to land on another planet, namely Mars. It is a national prestige issue.
So which missions are getting the axe? NASA is currently scheduled to work with the European Space Agency to send two probes to Mars in 2016 and 2018. And Space.com explains those missions, known as ExoMars, look like they're first on the chopping block. NASA is slated to provide the rockets for both ExoMars launches, as well as a variety of instrumentation for the orbiter and the rover. The U.S. Space Agency also is supposed to contribute the landing system for the rover's descent to the Martian surface. But NASA probably will have to pull out of the Mars effort now. In part, the budget cuts are due to NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. The telescope is billions of dollars over budget, taking resources away from other missions. Because it's become such a huge project, NASA has tweaked the design to try to make James Webb all things to all researchers. But a writer for Wired says that's a bad precedent for the agency. Packing multiple instruments into a single project leads to increased costs without necessarily delivering more science. Rather than working on enormous and expensive projects, perhaps the community could be better served with a suite of smaller, cheaper, more focused missions. The cuts won't affect the current Mars rover mission, already on its way to the Red Planet. The rover is on course for an August landing. For Newsy, I'm Megan Murphy. Multiple sources, the real story.
Well, there you have it. That's about as straight as the news can get on that subject. As you can see, some of the projects do run over budget. That's to be understood. New technology comes out as the programs get started. You go to Washington and ask for so much money, and then next year somebody invents a new instrument that could probably go on it. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's got to go on it. I mean, think if we had that right on the telescope, look who could see. And that's the way it goes. But these discoveries are really vital for the spirit of exploration for the human race. No, they don't have a lot of effect on military, but they do have an effect on the quality of life on the Earth. Many of the things that we learn from these projects do affect us and do benefit us. But I'd like to know what you think about it, 888-429-5471, to explore or not to explore. Is national prestige worth the cost? Do you think that he who controls space controls the Earth? Do you think that we should make cuts elsewhere to keep exploring? I know where I'd make my cuts. I'd make the cuts in all the money that goes to Planned Parenthood in exchange for a better space program. Gee, that's a no-brainer down here. But do you think that space will ever pay for itself? Now, if you really want to know about space, the best people to talk to are astronauts. So this is what Gene Cernan said about it.
The unforgettable words of Neil Armstrong, becoming the first man to walk on the moon. But America's supremacy in outer space is about to be challenged in a significant way as China announces an aggressive 5-year plan for the final frontier. Joining me live is the last American man to walk on the moon, the last man, former astronaut Gene Cernan. Gene, thank you so much for being back with us. This is quite an announcement from the Chinese. Now, they are saying that they have a 5-year plan for space exploration that will move them closer to going into outer space in a meaningful way. They've already vowed to build a space station and to put an astronaut on the moon, all of this while the American program is in retreat. Your reaction to the news?
Well, you know, it's really no surprise. The Chinese and the Asians in general seem to have a consistent program as they look towards the future. And this really surprises no one. What is a big surprise and what hurts and what I think all Americans better start thinking about is we've just abdicated our future leadership in space. And I think that's significantly important both from a civilian point of view, military point of view, and certainly it's going to have tremendous economic impact and make us vulnerable in the future.
How, I mean, to Americans who are watching this, because, you know, obviously it's always been the United States versus Russia in terms of space exploration. And it was almost a Cold War in outer space. And now you've got the Chinese. In 2003, they became the third country to send a human into space. And as we are sort of retreating a bit on our space program, and certainly on our plans to go back to the moon, which President Bush wanted to do, and President Obama says no, we get China saying, we'll do it. We'll fill the vacuum. Is it more than just a space race? Does it impact our countries as you know, economically and otherwise?
No, I think I don't think it's a space race. You know, we met Kennedy's, President JFK's challenge. We got to the moon. That truly was a space race. We needed to prove something, I think, to the world as well as to ourselves. I think this has got long-term implications. You know, economically, if the country that controls outer space in one way or another, the country that controls the high ground, you know, you think of a military war in space. I don't think so. I think it could be very well an economic war in space. If they control the capability to destroy satellites, for instance, or to interrupt communications, look what they're doing to our banking system. Look at our navigation system. They're going to put up a whole system of satellites, a GPS system of satellites, which is going to challenge those that we've already got up there. There are long-term implications for who truly will be the superpower, not only the intellectual but the technological superpower in the future. And as I said, we have abdicated. We can't. Yep. We won't, Megan. We won't be able to put an American on American piece of hardware till the end of the decade.
And I want to just put that picture.
Unacceptable.
I want to put these pictures up, in particular that one we showed first. This is you. On the moon. This is the man we are talking to, folks, Gene Cernan, an American hero, an astronaut on the moon, the last man to walk on the moon. And now we've got the Chinese saying they're going to begin the work to land their own astronauts on the moon when we've abandoned, you know, our plans. President Bush had called on NASA to return to the moon by 2020. That plan has now been canceled, Gene. And this is you. I mean, yeah. As the man who was in that suit doing this on the moon, how do you feel?
Not very good. Pretty disappointed. We knocked on the door. But it'll be 40 years ago. People don't realize I made those final steps 40 years ago, almost a half a century ago. We knocked on the door to the future. It was for the following generations to walk through that door, and who knows where they'd be now and what it would mean to the future of this, not just the country, but the future of the world of mankind. And we just backed down and quit, quite frankly. And a lot of people today, I get more questions from young men and young women in their 40s and 50s who were in diapers or knee pants and say, why did we quit? Why didn't we go on? When are we going back? The whole nation hasn't yet fully grasped, I think, the situation that we're being put in by the president administration.
President Obama says he wants to go explore an asteroid or other goals instead of the moon because we've already been there. Your thoughts on that, Gene, and your thoughts on how this just, you know, I mean, it seems like the NASA program switches depending on who we have in the Oval Office. There's no consistency.
Well, you know, going to an asteroid, big deal. There's a rock out there. What's it going to tell us? I'm not even sure we can land on an asteroid. You know, been there, done that by going to the moon doesn't sell as far as I'm concerned. We've been to six places on the moon. We've discovered now that there's water on the moon. We know there's helium-3 and then there's other minerals. Besides, the moon is somehow a very convenient place from which to decide where we go from here. You know, curiosity is the essence of human existence. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? How long are we going to be here? It gives us a platform in which to look to the future and answer those questions, I think, that we all want to know. And we're cheating. We're cheating future generations. And when you look at the young kids of the day, what's really inspired them? What, Megan, your generation, what's inspired you to dream? It's Neil Armstrong steps on the moon. They don't exist any. The steps exist, but the future from where we can go after those steps is very much in question.
Yeah. Before I let you go, Gene, and I know you've been asked this a million times, but it's not every day we get to talk to you, and I love hearing your stories. As we cue back up the video of you on the moon, bouncing across the surface, what was that like?
It's nostalgic to think about. It was 13 years out of my life, and quite frankly, Megan, sometimes I wonder if it really happened. Was it a dream? My life was going on. Things seemed to be, a naval aviator, and all of a sudden, bang, I was pulled out of that existence of my life. I went to the moon. And do I think about it occasionally when people like you and others ask me about it? I know it happened. I know it was important. But I feel there's something missing, because what did we do? What does that 13 years of my life mean to future generations? And I haven't been able to answer that yet. And the answer to that question is now more in jeopardy than it's ever been. We will go back. And I tell those young kids, they're the ones that are going to take us back. If you and I and others give them the same opportunity someone gave us when we were their age, it will happen.
Gene, you are an inspiration in the way you've led your life for many of us. Thank you so much for being back in the program.
All right. There you go. That was Gene Cernan, and that was very inspiring words to me. And what Megan said is a good point. It seems like the NASA budgeting and the prospect for future exploration into space changes with whoever's in the Oval Office. There's no consistency. That is simply because we rely upon the government for all the funding to NASA. It needs to be privatized. A $1.5 billion budget for space exploration is absolutely ridiculous. When we spend somewhere between $1.5 and $2 trillion a year on national defense, against what? I have no idea. And we spend that on a space exploration program. It's ridiculous. We should be spending at least $1 trillion a year exploring space. Because if we don't, someone else will. And Gene had it exactly right. The country that controls the high ground, and by this I'm talking about the moon, will control the earth. Now, since this is really tied to the economy and the science of money, I'll close by talking a little bit about the dollar. it's all about mathematics, but it's also I just want to call it criminal activity. Right now, the world is focused on the Eurozone. This is what happened when a group of states that once had their own currencies and their own economies come together to form a single currency, the euro. The problem happened when the European Union, which is a very labor-friendly and not so production-friendly, has allowed a welfare state to develop more so in other countries than in the core countries like Germany. Well, this is what happens when a windfall of value surges into an economy that does not become more productive with that money. It's sort of like starting with dessert and then having a happy hour. You don't get a lot done, okay? So the Eurozone adopted lazy kids with 30-hour work weeks and free medical care, and they went broke. Now, here is the greater news on the current up-to-date health of the Eurozone. This is important because we already had $2.2 trillion sucked out of our repaid bank bailout funds and just handed over to the Eurozone to shore up their credit markets. There was not a single ounce of value exchanged. We just gave them our tax dollars that had already been laundered through the Federal Reserve, and it was devastating. It was devastating to them, and it's devastating to us, and it only postponed the inevitable. Listen up.
Crisis in the Eurozone. President Obama today meeting with members of the European Union here in Washington. The meeting comes at a time in which many see the Eurozone as being on life support after economic collapse seems to be spreading. Now, we've already seen Greece, Portugal, and Ireland bailed out, but now the Eurozone's third and fourth largest economies, Italy and Spain, are also under threat. Today's meeting is seen by some as a last-ditch attempt to save the Eurozone, with even some top experts predicting the Eurozone has just 10 days left to live if a major solution is not found by its next meeting on December 9th. Certainly, whatever happens could have a global impact. World leaders are concerned, they're worried, some even pointing fingers. Here's Nigel Farage, co-president of the Europe for Freedom and Democracy Group, expressing his anger at the situation.
You are all in denial. By any objective measure, the euro is a failure. And who is actually responsible? Who's in charge out of you lot? Well, of course, the answer is none of you, because none of you have been elected. None of you actually have any democratic legitimacy for the roles that you currently hold within this crisis.
Now, Nigel Farage has doubted the eurozone from the beginning, but his view is one that even some original believers are starting to adopt, that the eurozone just may be a failure. Let's go now to Joe Weisenthal, deputy editor for the Business Insider. Hey there, Joe. On one hand, this is a dire situation, but it seems that the only time things actually happen is when we are in dire situations. So I'm wondering what you think. Is this the end of the eurozone as we know it?
You know, you're absolutely correct. I think it takes for a crisis to really get to the edge to spur people to act. I mean, this has been festering for at least 2 years. The first time we started talking about the Greek crisis was October 2009, actually, and here we are. But here's the problem. Because there are so many leaders in the Eurozone, 17 countries within the euro itself and the more countries in the EU, even if everyone decides to act at the last second, there's no guarantee it happens because you have this tremendous problem of coordinating various national interests.
Good point. And I want to bring this up. There are some rumblings, I guess you could say, that the International Monetary Fund is in the process of coming up with a plan to step in and help out, at least with Italy. There is talk of a 600 billion euro assistance package, though the IMF is denying this. But I want to get your take on what you think would be some of the consequences of the IMF getting involved here.
Well, the first thing to realize is it's hard to believe that the IMF has that kind of money. Right now, the fund just is, you know, it'd have to borrow money from the ECB in some kind of way if we're going to do anything like that. And right now, that's being denied. But I think the broader point is the last few days have seen a real flurry of rumors about, you know, something big happening, whether it's the IMF or the ECB or some kind of stability pact or fiscal union or euro bonds. So something is cooking. You're just seeing too many headlines for there not to be something up, but we just can't figure it out.
I know.
The problem with just the IMF bailing out Italy is that even if it happened, it wouldn't solve the fundamental problem because the euro has a structural flaw. It's not just about the debt in these countries, but about the flawed aspects of all these countries sharing a currency. And unless the solution actually gets at the heart of that problem, nothing is going to work.
It is really interesting also to see IMF Chief Christine Lagarde in Latin America this week, not doing what the IMF usually does in Latin America, which is, you know, imposing austerity measures. No, this time she's asking countries like Brazil, for example, for help. I'm wondering if you, I mean, this is seems to me like a total role reversal, but do you think this is one of the strategies? You said the IMF doesn't have the money. The ECB probably doesn't. Is this what's going on here?
Well, I think actually it is seem to be, that does seem to be, you know, behind the scenes trying to get the BRICS to invest in Europe. But I think it's a scandal. And the reason is that fundamentally, you know, the BRIC countries remain much poorer than European countries. Sure, on the surface, they seem broke. But the problem is not enough money in Europe. The problem is a bad structure. The problem is the fact that the countries don't have control over their own currencies.
All right. So we have countries that don't have control over their own currencies. And this is a familiar problem because we don't have control over our own currency either. As I said, all of this was shored up with American dollars. And now you see that the IMF can't simply just write a check for 600 billion euros. It ain't going to happen. We already did that once. And as Anne Barnhart reported on this program a couple of months ago, there's about $100 trillion worth of debt and only about $40 trillion worth of value. The numbers don't add up. Somebody has ripped us off. And when the value ran out of the dollar, the Fed just printed more. Jay Leno said it the best when he made a Super Bowl comment about this. He said, the trouble with the global Super Bowl being at halftime, China has the ball, and we're down by $16 trillion. The dollar will collapse unless we stop this crazy government spending that does not generate any form of return. The space program does generate a return. The defense program does not. And the dollar is collapsing. If you don't believe me, here's a world expert on the dollar.
Everybody, Fabian for Liberty. You're watching Internet Anchorman TV. Thank you for joining me. The stock market rallies up over like 450 points. And what a day for celebration. I mean, it's like the sheeple are having literally a parade on CNBC, how brilliant, you know, Ben Bernanke is, how brilliant the banking elites are. And people literally buy into this. Like, I'm driving home yesterday. I'm listening to Neocon Talk Radio. And they're like, you know, hey, they've come up with a great, you know, a great solution to the euro crisis. And the Fed is so brilliant and things are better again. And the newscast, the people doing the newscast are saying, great day for celebration. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, the markets are completely rigged. Everybody will lose all their money, at least the money that is in the market. Most of it's high-frequency trading, and we'll break all that down. But it's an absolute scam. It's a Ponzi scheme. And they're celebrating it like it's some big kind of, you know, big news. So we're going to break all of that down. But I thought the best analogy, this was one of the kind of most interesting stories that I've ever heard. And it has to do with the mind and how people can't get out of the normalcy bias and how your current perspective on life, you know, it's like this, you're going down this road and you can't imagine anything else being different, right? You can't, it's like you can't plan for a black swan. You think America will always be America. It's similar to European settlers that, you know, a bunch of them in their journals and in their diaries when they first approached and landed in Mesoamerica or the Americas, Central America, the story goes that they landed the big flagged ships in the harbor, okay? And then they would take the little ships. The European settlers would go on the little ships, and they would take those up to the beach. And the Indians, the natives, they were able to see the small ships, the little boats. They were able to see those coming into the shore and landing on the beach. They could recognize that. But they physically, they could not see the tall ships out in the harbor. Now, this has been documented by dozens of explorers that all said the same exact thing. The shamans, however, for the natives, they were able to see the tall ships, and they literally had to help the rest of the tribe say, wait, no, keep looking. And eventually they were able to say, yeah, wow, look at those enormous ships with the flags and the gigantic sails. It was out of their, they had just never seen anything like that ever in their life. They'd never imagined it. They never expected it. They never knew that possibility. So they were literally blinded to it. And that's the world that we live in today with the economy.
Okay, that's the world we live in with the economy. Now, maybe so. I understand that the dollar, you know, is collapsing, that the euro, there's no way to save it. You know where Europe is going to come for help. They're going to come to us. Well, I'm sorry, the taxpayers have had enough. But is there a plan? Yes. Yes, there is a plan, and it has already been announced ahead of time, so we know exactly what's going to happen, okay? What's going to happen is we're going to go back to war, and just to let you know that the elites have tipped their hand, here it is again, World War III is already underway, okay? Here we go.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon, and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second. I said, well, you're too busy. He said, no. He says, we've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk and picked up a piece of paper. He said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Okay, now you heard the list of countries, right? We had Libya in there, done. We had Syria in there, on the news almost every single day. No official reporting going on, no official reporting, but we know what's going on in Syria. There are tanks and troops bombing, shelling, and shooting civilians on the streets. You know that Syria is the hinge pin of Muslim aristocracy, okay, anciently. It is important that Syria continue. That's why anything that's going on in Syria is very, very clandestine right now. But all those other countries have already been mentioned, have already been in some sort of war, except one, and that's Iran. It's the only one left. Keep listening to this general.
The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you. But there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
Well, I think that Iran is a dangerous power. I think it's a hegemonistic power. It would like to have greater control in the Middle East. It is a threat to the nations in the Middle East. And as the president said, if it had nuclear weapons, it could be a threat to the United States as well.
Do you think that the United States can stop Iran from obtaining those nuclear weapons through diplomacy, especially given with all these sanctions that we have? I was in Iran a few months ago. They seem to get plenty of what they need, in part from, well, places like China.
If the United States could bring China and Russia to bear, if we really went after the sanctions in the toughest possible way, if we're willing to impact Iran's ability to deal in oil, then I think it's possible that sanctions could have a decisive impact. I think sanctions are already having an impact. Mm-hmm. I think there's no question that we've made it tougher on the Iranian regime, but it's clear that the Iranian regime seems determined to move ahead.
Now, I can tell you right now, I agree with Ron Paul here, that sanctions are already the prelude to war. And every single one of the countries that he mentioned have already been listed, have already been either conquered or sent into a state of turmoil, either through internal strife or through this thing called the Arab Spring, which is a revolt of the people trying to be represented, and yet the army stepping in and taking over everything. One by one, these countries will all be aligned into one massive force. And the sanctions are not really working because they're getting everything they need from China anyway. And you already know that China and Russia have both vetoed the actions that are taking place in Iran right now. So there you have the big picture. We've put it all in one three-hour program. You can go back and listen to all the pieces, and you can put it together for yourself. It has been well-crafted. It has been well-engineered. But now you are empowered, so you can do something about it. You have roughly 8 months left, a little less than 8 months, to make your decision and decide how you're going to participate in this democratic process. So let us know. Send us mail. I'm at bagnew@x2-radio.com. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, We bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.